Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Bandettini, and here I discuss all things brain imaging with scientists from around the world. Today, my guest is Dr. Russ Poldrack, who has been so influential to the fields of fMRI, cognitive neuroscience, and brain imaging in general for the past 30 plus years. Russ is the Albert Ray Lang Professor of Psychology at Stanford University and Director of the Center for Open and Reproducible Science. Over the years, he has helped elevate how we do fMRI by creating resources and standards for sharing data and code. He's also working to advance the precision with which we think about task design and data interpretation through his Cognitive Atlas project, which is a knowledge base for cognitive neuroscience. Russ received his bachelor's in psychology from Baylor University in 1989 and his PhD from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in 1995. After a postdoc at Stanford, he started in 1999 as an assistant professor at Harvard University and Mass General Hospital. In 2002, he moved to UCLA, and then in 2009, he became director of the Imaging Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Finally, in 2014, he was recruited to Stanford, where he has been ever since. In this discussion, we look into some of the paradigm shifts in fMRI best practices that Russ helped foster, as well as some of the big picture challenges that we face when using brain imaging, modeling, and precision task design to derive new insights into brain organization and mechanisms of computation. Here, Russ also weighs in on the prospects of fMRI for biomarker derivation, as well as the exciting potential for single subject deep imaging. I mentioned to Russ that this was one of the fastest hours I've experienced in quite some time, as it was a completely engrossing discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, Russ, thanks for joining us today. I think that of all the people I've interviewed, practically, you don't really need an introduction. Your influence has been so profound over the past, 30 years. I guess we're about the same age. I noticed that looking at your CV and everything. But and your influence, I mean, you've been, you know, you started in cognitive neuroscience, and then you've sort of moved into a form of meta science, sort of trying to make the field better, and you've been quite effective in that, sort of leading the way in open data, sharing code, opening up how we interact with our data, such that hopefully that the quality of the data and the quality of the science can be improved. So just to begin, so let's start at the beginning. We're going to cover all kinds of things. Your history, how did you start? And you know, you can go back as far as you want, as far as, you know, when you first became interested in neuroscience and what piqued your interest?
Cool. Yeah. Well, first, thanks for the invitation. It's really fun to be here. I'll start close to the beginning. You know, when I went to college, I knew I always wanted to be a scientist as a kid, but I didn't know enough to know how to do that. So I thought the way to be a scientist was to be a physician. So I went to college and I was going to be pre-med. And then I kind of realized that, you know, there was a lot of stuff there that just wasn't of interest to me, particularly my first chemistry class. You know, at the same time, I started getting really interested in philosophy, actually. So I kind of picked psychology as a major because it kind of sat halfway between my scientific interest and my philosophical interest. But I minored in philosophy and ended up, you know, sort of thinking a lot about those sort of things. And the place I went to college didn't actually have anybody who was a cognitive psychologist, or they had some people doing like animal neuroscience stuff. But I was lucky to have a mentor who had Bud Barker, who had come up as an animal learning person, but he convinced me to kind of like think about, you know, cognitive science, cognitive psychology. And my entree was really through reading kind of the philosophy of mind. I think the book that sort of cemented my interest in the area was Daniel Dennett's Brainstorms, which is a bunch of, you know, kind of individual essays about different aspects of philosophy of mind. But it really kind of, you know, got me excited about that. And so I still didn't really kind of know what I was doing. I'd never had a cognitive psychology class, but I applied to cognitive psychology graduate programs and ended up somehow getting into a couple of them. And so I went to University of Illinois. And first I was just going to be a straight up cognitive psychologist and spent a couple of years doing that. And then Neil Cohen moved to Illinois, who was well known for his work in memory and amnesia. And I kind of got excited about that and joined his lab. So my first entree into neuroscience was really through neuropsychological studies of patients. Though my dissertation ended up being pure cognitive psychology with some computational modeling stuff. So I came to Stanford to do a postdoc, and I didn't come here to do imaging at all. I came here to study patients. I was interested in skill acquisition and the role of the basal ganglia. And when I got here, this was 1995. So, fMRI was just taking off in earnest at that point. And Stanford was one of the hotbeds of interest at that point. And I got here and, the access to patients wasn't as good as I had expected. And at the same time, there was so much excitement about, fMRI, and particularly it sort of appealed to my geeky side. I've been programming since I was in probably junior high. And really enjoyed kind of the computational side of it, and so I got kind of sucked into doing fMRI around 1996, and ended up being the primary focus of my postdoc and really of my career since then. I ended up having several faculty jobs. I went to Mass General first and had a position there for 3 years inside the Martino Center, or what was then the NMR Center. One of the places where fMRI was invented, if you will. And that was super fun. But then ended up moving to UCLA in 2003 and had fun there. And then I had an opportunity to move to University of Texas to start a new imaging center in 2009, did that, and then had an opportunity to come back to the West Coast in 2014. And I've been here at Stanford ever since.
Okay. It's interesting. You mentioned a couple of things that sort of resonate with me. I had also started, kind of thinking along the lines of being an MD, but then I once again, it was sort of like the chemistry classes and organic chemistry classes. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure if I really want to do this. I'm more interested in and also I was sort of interested in philosophy, but I took the physics route and then, right. But I was still interested in the brain. I took a neuropsychology class but then went physics. But it's interesting how paths sort of converge on certain things over time.
Indeed.
As far as your first fMRI work is concerned, it was the standard, you collect, back in the 90s, obviously people collected 10 subjects, 20 subjects was considered a lot. And, 100 subjects was considered, overkill. But then over time, the worry is that there were a lot of studies that were not necessarily replicable or reproducible. At what point in time, and we'll get into your work a little bit later, but at what point in time did it hit you that something needs to be done about this, and sort of along the lines of what particularly needed to be done?
Yeah, I think that the biggest kick was probably when Ed Voll's famous voodoo correlations paper started circulating, before its publication. I think people were sending it around 2008 or so. It highlighted this one particular kind of circular analysis practice that I realized we had been doing. That paper focused on kind of like social neuroscience, but a lot of people were doing exactly the same thing, and realized we had done it. We ended up going back, and Jeanette Mumford and I kind of dug in and looked at how big of an effect did that actually have on our data, on our results. But that really highlighted to me the need for us to think a lot more about what we're doing with our analyses and how they might or might not sort of lead us astray. Then a couple years after that, the whole sort of reproducibility crisis in psychology really kicked in, I guess, 2010, 2011, when people started, paying a lot of attention to the fact that there were findings that were pretty clearly non-replicable. People started thinking about issues like p-hacking, and statistical power also, became a big issue. That really became clear in 2013 with the Kate Button and colleagues published this power failure paper, which highlighted the fact that across across a number of different aspects of neuroscience, not just imaging, that there was, you know, low power, and highlighted the fact that, you know, low power can lead you to have a high degree of, like, you know, of false positive results. Yeah. And so all those things kind of came together to make me be really concerned. And I'm somebody who, you know, wants to do something. And so, you know, I asked myself, what can we do to try to make it better? And I've always been kind of, you know, looking back, I mean, I was doing open source software, you know, I had I think my earliest open source thing that I released was this SPM ROI toolbox back around like 2002 on, you know, SourceForge, MATLAB code. And so I've always, you know, thought that sort of, you know, openness was a good idea. I've always been a fan of open source software. And this was, you know, right around the time that people were starting to think that data sharing was actually a good thing to do. You know, people had tried to do data sharing back around 2000 with the fMRI data center. That sort of, you know, I think got hung up because the field wasn't ready for it.
Yep.
You know, around 20, I think the big, the Biswal, Milam, PNAS paper was around 2010, I think. Which basically showed, hey, look, if a bunch of people come together and amass data, you can answer questions you couldn't have answered with any of your little small data sets. And so we started, the first sort of effort on our part was the Open fMRI project, which I think we launched around 2012 or so.
Okay.
Which, you know, aimed to share, quote unquote, raw fMRI data. And we can argue about what raw means, but yeah. And so, so that was, you know, that was really, I think my entree was really the Vull paper kind of getting me kicked off. And then, the replication price crisis kind of really pushing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing how to, you know, sort of along the lines of how do you actually, I mean, you could just write a bunch of editorial papers or, you know, position papers about this and try to change the field, but actually trying to, and also certainly there's other avenues too, like, you know, with OHVM, we're trying to do, you know, best practices and then the Kubitis paper and things like that, but actually making tools and fostering large databases certainly help this. And so, you know, you have, I mean, I just checking out your website. I mean, you have, several things now that are up and running that are pretty much thriving. Open Neuro, which is, you know, the new data sharing platform, which is actually kind of now the go-to place for sharing data sets. And you have other things that we'll talk about, the Cognitive Atlas, and then certainly with Chris Gorgolowski, you and I guess Tal Yocconi, you started NeuroVault and NeuroSynth, which, you know, I remember Chris Gorgolowski talking to me about NeuroVault, and then the idea that, you know, you save your, you know, sort of statistical maps, and then all papers published in NeuroImage or even other journals are then scraped for this data, which is really, I found extremely useful as well in many ways. And then of course you've helped form, and I think it's really important, the standard for data sharing BIDS. You were part of that effort as well. Which is really important, but all of these, it's hard because you're building this structure. You want to, you know, make the best use of it. And also, like, for instance, even with BIDS, you have a data structure and certainly people have their own way of doing things. And it's, some people might say it's not intuitive or whatever, but you have to agree on something. And, right. But it's really hard also because the field, you know, how you acquire data, the quality of the data, or even subtle aspects of the data, you know, that's all continuously changing. So you're trying to set up this structure and also be able to make it adapt to these changes as well, like as things become a little bit different. But
yeah. And I mean, I think the success of BIDS, you know, largely, you know, kind of rides on the fact that, you know, Chris Gorlevsky was, you know, really good at engaging the community. Cause, you know, I think that these things, you know, a failure mode for these kind of things is if it's like, you know, viewed as one lab's project, right? And rather than something that the community owns. And I think Chris did a great job of making sure that it, you know, that it from the earliest part of the project, that everybody had a say, that we listened to all the voices. We didn't always do everything all the voices asked for, right? Because we also had a set of principles like, you know, the sort of 80-20 rule, right? We wanted to make the thing work well for most people most of the time, you know, for most use cases. And that requires that sometimes it's not going to work for some people. And, you know, we just have to kind of, you know, make peace with that. So I think one, you know, one was like really being community minded. And then two was like thinking, you know, as you said, thinking upfront about extensibility, right? The first, you know, when we had the first BIDS meeting back in 2015, we were focused really only on MRI, on basically fMRI, structural MRI, and, you know, maybe talking about diffusion, but diffusion wasn't really a big part of the discussion then. We built in an extension mechanism that was sort of inspired by this Python extension proposal mechanism, so that because we knew that, you know, things are going to change, as you said, and we need to be able to change the standard. We need to be able to extend it as new people come into the community. So the most of the extensions to date have been for new data types, right? So, you know, we've added scalp EEG, intracranial EEG, PET, FNIRs now. And I think that's been, you know, even though most, like if you go to Open Neuro, which, you know, Open Neuro, really the reason we step back a second, the reason that the big motivation for starting BIDS was, you know, we had run OpenFMRI, and to get data into OpenFMRI, we had kind of our own bespoke data organization scheme. People would send us their data and we'd have to reorganize it into the data scheme. And the only way we could tell if we had successfully done it was we'd go run our analysis pipeline on it. And if the pipeline crashed, that meant we didn't have the scheme right. So so we knew that one, we needed to get, we couldn't afford to hire enough people to do this for every data set. We needed to give people a way to organize the data themselves so that they could click one button and upload the data, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why having an automated validator that could basically look at a data set before it's uploaded and say, is it a valid BIDS data set? That was like central to what we did up front. And so then, you know, so basically any data set that passes the validator can be uploaded to Open Neuro. So that means now PET data, intracranial EEG data, FNIRS data, you know, all these different types of data can be uploaded without us having to really do anything other than update the validator to say, hey, PET is okay now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That would be right. That would be a ton of work to further curate the data once it's sent to you. Yeah. And certainly you have to do that. One has to be sort of aware of, you know, other things like, for instance, like, you know, I can even imagine like multi-echo data is a slightly different, yeah. Format that or some additional file system that you might have to incorporate or something like that.
And we, you know, I mean, to its credit, the BIDS community, I think, has been really good about thinking through how to deal with this stuff in an extensible way. So, you know, they came up with a scheme for encoding, you know, the necessary metadata around multi-echo so that you can easily share those. Yeah. An even bigger challenge is, you know, if you want to share data that had been processed, right, what we call derivative data, by processed, I mean beyond just reconstruction of the images or whatever the scanner does, and then conversion into Nifty or one of the formats that we handle, you know, that's the Wild West, right? You know, so the number, you know, fortunately, we're lucky. I mean, one of the reasons I think data sharing works so well in neuroimaging is because, you know, all the data come off the scanner digitally, right? We're not writing things down for the most part. I mean, we write a few things down in notebooks, but the data are for the most part, you know, all digital. And we amazingly, you know, thanks to the work of Bob Cox and others 20 something years ago, we had the standard Nifty, right? Which all the software pretty much handles. So, you know, we're so far ahead of, there's a lot of other fields of science where they haven't even agreed on data formats yet, or their data formats are proprietary. So you have to buy an expensive piece of software even just to read the data. Yeah. So I think we had a lot of advantages up front, thanks to earlier community work.
Yeah. 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 I remember that. I remember that meeting. At least they had one of the meetings at the NIH where, you know, Bob Cox and Friston and Jonathan Cohen were sort of, you know, debating as to, you know, what the best format was. And yeah, I think that was early 2000s. Yeah. And that certainly these sort of things set the groundwork. So as far as Open Neuro is concerned, I mean, it's growing rapidly. I mean, you have, right, MRI, PET, MEG, EEG, and others. The intended purpose is mostly, you know, there's many, and one is to sort of be able to have the data there so other groups can go in and reanalyze the data in their own way, or sort of look at something more subtle, or maybe compare or test analyzing, you know, test new software. How has that worked out? Have people been downloading and reanalyzing, and how, you know, Have there been any surprises or right. things like that?
I think, you know, we have the metrics suggest that it's getting a lot of downloads. I can't remember what the numbers are, but, you know, certainly terabytes have been downloaded in the last few years. In terms of surprises, I mean, I think, you know, so one thing I should say up front is, like, you know, we had a reproducibility goal, but we also had a data aggregation goal, because I realized, you know, around like 2009, we became really interested in sort of decoding across lots of different tasks, right? Yep. Sort of related to our Cognitive Atlas interests.
Yeah.
But we didn't think that we had the ability to go in and collect data on a lot of people across a lot of different tasks. And so part of the goal of Open Neuro was to have people aggregate all their data so that we can pull it together and try to start, you know, kind of using it to do larger scale sort of analyses. We're finally starting to do some of that stuff, and I can say a bit about that. But, you know, also the reproducibility angle was we thought an important one. The one pleasant surprise is that there have been, I can't think of any kind of at least high profile cases where of kind of gotcha sort of analyses where somebody took somebody's data set and came along and said, hey, you know, you did this wrong. We can't replicate your data, blah, blah, blah. I think that, or, you know, cases of people sort of complaining about being scooped on analyses or something like that. I think it's mostly been, I would say the biggest use cases have been people who want to develop novel analysis methods who don't have the ability to collect data themselves or the expertise to collect data themselves. They can just easily come and collect all sorts of different data. You know, aggregation. So people, you know, want to analyze across multiple data sets on a particular task. And there's obviously, you know, there's certain tasks where we have more data than others. But, you know, for example, for the stop signal task, people have done analyses aggregating a number of different data sets across different studies. I think it's been really important for training. So if you want to put on a course and show people real data and have them work with real data, you know, you can just grab the data easily from Open Neuro and do that. I mean, I'll just mention kind of one sort of larger scale thing that we've done recently that starts to, I think, really point at the utility of like these really big data sets. So, you know, we've been inspired by the work going on in large language models, which have shown that, you know, you can take these big models like GPT-3 and pre-train them on a ton of text, right? And then take those models and sort of do additional training on smaller data, right? And sort of leverage the representations learned in pre-training to then kind of fine tune them. So what Armin Thomas and my group did, this is a paper he presented at NeurIPS last year. He took not all of Open Neuro. He took like, you know, a little over 1,000 subjects, I think about 11,000 experimental runs worth of data from Open Neuro across all sorts of different tasks, like basically not worrying about what the task was, and just pre-trained these models, used architectures of like these transformer architectures like you're using large language models, where you're just learning to predict the next time point.
Yeah.
That's all. You just give it a bunch of data and say, for each of these time series, just learn to predict the next time point. And yes. What that does is it trains it to learn representations of what fMRI data look like overall, right? Yes. Then he takes the representations learned in this model and uses it to develop decoders to, for example, you know, let's take the human connectome data. We want to decode at any particular point, what task is a person engaged in of the, like, you know, 20 something different tasks contrast we might be able to pull out of that data set.
Yes.
And what he shows is that, you can build decoders that are much more effective with much less data. Like, you can build a decoder based on 20 subjects that works really well when you use the pre-trained model, whereas you're much worse if you just try to, you know, develop a decoder from scratch using the same data. So it starts to highlight, you know, once we have these very large data, and that was only using probably, you know, less than 5% of the relevant data from Open Neuro that he could have used, just because that was all we had pre-processed at that point. One thing we're doing right now is actually trying to go through and run as much data as possible on Open Neuro through fMRI prep to pre-process it, so that if people want pre-processed data for all these data sets, we can just hand it to them.
Okay. So that's really cool. So then the goal of this then would be to, right, to be able to put in any data set. I'm sure you've done this, you know, without the paradigm, and actually predict what was the task in some sense.
Exactly.
And Have you tried, this is something that sort of we're kind of trying to do is look at resting state. I mean, it would be interesting to apply this to resting state to see, you know, transient thought process.
Right. I think that's a really cool idea. We have not tried that yet. We've been pretty focused on sort of task stuff.
Yeah. So I'll hold this thought for a while before we go into the cognitive ontologies, because it does seem like this is directly relevant to that, because, you know, you want to have this space of tasks and you want to have this space of data, and you're trying to, you know, come up with relationships between the two and sort of build a structure. And yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the whole goal of fMRI in some sense. I mean, this is pretty much it. And I think, right, these decoders, this GPT-3 type sort of things is kind of...
And the challenge, I mean, you know, for us, this is something we've wanted to do for a long time. The challenge is how do you, you know, you need enough... I mean, obviously you can get a long way using kind of self-supervised learning, like I mentioned, but ultimately you need data that are actually annotated with what task is this person doing at this time? And then what are the cognitive components of that task? And right, that's what the ontologies are meant to give us, right?
Right.
And the problem is we've not had those kind of like, you know, detailed annotated data sets, and it, you know, there's no automated way to do that right now. Somebody who understands the task has to go in and say, hey, I think this particular working memory task involves, you know, requires visual object recognition and also involves like, you know, working memory updating or whatever cognitive functions we think might be going on. Right. But yeah, the goal, I mean, one way to frame the goal is for any, you know, I would like to be able to take a new cognitive task that you describe to me and you say, hey, I'm going to do this particular task and it involves these particular psychological functions. One way to think about this is that, you know, we'd like to, for any particular new cognitive task that we've never seen before, if we know the cognitive functions that it engaged, we should be able to predict the activation map.
Yeah.
For that new task, based on what we know about how those cognitive functions are mapped to the brain from other tasks. And so we had a paper in NeuroImage just, I guess it came out last year from John Walters in my group and others, where we got a start at this using a data set that was developed by Jørn Diedrichsen and Rich Ivory and Maeve King and colleagues. This, it's called a multi-domain task battery data set. And it's a data set where you have individuals, each individual, I think, had about 5 hours of data collection doing a bunch of different tasks. We end up having like 40 something different task contrast. So we went through and analyzed each of those task contrasts in detail to figure out what psychological functions do we think are required to do this particular task. And then basically developed encoding models where we basically say, for this task, you have these particular cognitive functions engaged. For this task, you have these cognitive functions engaged. And then for every, we didn't do it on voxels. We did it in like, you know, regions of the brain, like 1,000 regions.
Yeah.
In this region, how does it respond on each of those particular tasks? And then we can basically fit a model in that area to say, how is it responding to each of those cognitive functions? Then for some new task, we know what cognitive functions it engages. We can predict, we can just basically invert the model and predict what should the activation map look like for that particular task. And it turns out we can do reasonably well. We can do reasonably well, at least within subjects. We can do not as well, but, you know, decently predicting from one subject to another.
So that brings to mind the challenge of, you know, it seems to me that, you've talked about this before, you're trying to draw inferences about the cognitive functions associated with the brain activation, but it seems that there's potentially this inverse problem both ways. I mean, it seems like there's potentially the tasks might not uniquely map to the activation, and the activation might not uniquely map to the task in some regard. And so, it'd be interesting how to, I mean, maybe in the context of fMRI, that's not a problem for most things, but I mean, I don't know what your thoughts on that. Yeah.
I think it's a really hard problem. I think you're exactly right that, you know, certainly, you know, tasks and even, you know, what we think of as cognitive functions almost certainly don't map one-to-one to brain areas, right? And it's also the case that at least, you know, I think this varies more across tasks, but, you know, from person to person, the way that a particular task maps back to the brain may differ, you know, because of their expertise, because of the strategy that they use to perform the task. Some tasks can be done in different ways. You know, there's lots of reasons that that could differ across people. I think there's a deeper challenge, which is that, and this was also part of the motivation for starting to think about cognitive ontologies, you know, 13, 14 years ago. You know, we as psychologists have labels for cognitive functions. We think that there's a thing that we do called working memory maintenance, or a thing called phonological assembly, or whatever it might be, right? But those are just kind of human verbal labels for computations that are being done in brain tissue, right? And not, you know, so the question is like, what, you know, ultimately, if we think that it's an open question as to whether, you know, a particular brain area can be even characterized as doing a single computation, right? It might well be that they do different computations when they're talking to different other parts of the brain, and, you know, in terms of dynamics and so on. But, you know, let's say that you could, let's say that it does make sense to characterize a particular brain area in terms of a computation. The language in which we describe those computations is almost certainly not going to be, you know, human natural language, right? It's going to be a computational language. And I think this has become really clear as people have started to try to understand and characterize how functions take place in artificial neural networks.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was this kind of well-known paper a couple of years ago from Blake Richards and colleagues, which laid out this vision for basically, you know, using artificial neural networks as sort of models of the brain, right?
Yeah.
And it's, that paper said pretty explicitly that trying to like explain in human language what a particular part of a neural network is doing is a futile effort. Right. That instead you need to think about it in terms of these things like, you know, neural network architectures and learning rules and objective functions. That's something that I've been struggling with a lot, because I think there's almost certainly something right about it, right? That, you know, the complexity of what our brains are doing and what our minds are doing is almost certainly not captured well by the kind of gross verbal labels that psychologists have come up with over the last 50 years. But the question is like, how do we, you know, what's the next step, right? I'm not satisfied by, you know, by saying, oh, if I take a deep neural network and like have it learn a task, and then I see that, you know, units or regions in that network are predictive of activity in different parts of the brain, as people have been doing for a number of years. I'm not satisfied just stopping there and saying, hey, look, the thing that that part of the network does maps onto that thing that the brain network does, but we can't say anything about what it is. That doesn't satisfy me, but the question is, how do you get from there to something that satisfies you without sacrificing, you know, kind of fidelity to what the system's actually doing?
So right. I mean, it seems like the problem there, I mean, there's two sides of the problem. One is sort of defining the task as, you know, the computation or the task itself in a way that is more, you know, mechanistic in some sense, but it also seems that, I mean, you know, I think about fMRI data, you know, can fMRI data or even EEG data or any of the data that we collect actually get at what, I often say, you know, I don't even know what a computation looks like in terms of fMRI. And fMRI gives you, you know, it gives you magnitude, it gives you some dynamics, it gives you, you know, location. But can, is it possible? I mean, and I always, you know, when I talk to people about using fMRI to inform models of what's going on, you know, how deeply can fMRI data inform these models? And, you know, it's when you just get, you know, blobs or maybe some features of activation, can you actually get at, you know, maybe, you know, what's the relevant scale to actually understand, you know, the important mechanisms?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And obviously, you know, we've made those of us who've been doing fMRI for a while have kind of made a bet that this, you know, relatively kind of like mesoscale, you know, few millimeters scale can tell us something useful. And I think that, you know, there's certainly been some success using fMRI to do that. And even at the higher scale, right? The identification of these large scale networks that have come primarily starting, you know, from resting state fMRI. I think that's an interesting new discovery about brain function and brain functional organization that we didn't know about before, right? The question is like, you know, how useful is that for understanding in more detail the actual computations that are going on? And I think that there's, you know, what we know about complex systems in general, right, is they have this kind of multi-scale organization. And I think that, I mean, I still hope that there is something to be learned from, you know, even if what we're looking at the mesoscale is sort of echoes of the computation that can only be fully described at the micro scale, that those echoes can still be useful in the same way that, you know, that astronomers can use echoes of, you know, cosmic microwave background or whatever to try to learn things about, you know, the early universe, even though, you know, those are nowhere near the kinds of measurements you would like to have to know in detail what was going on, you know, seconds after the Big Bang.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems that, right. I mean, it seems that you have these three levels. I mean, you have you want to make, you know, very precise ontologies and models of what's going on. You also have your, you know, you also could have very low level sort of neural network models that you test to see, you know, how that might emerge, you know, to show this activation. Then you have your data in the middle. And it seems that some iteration between all those two levels, you know, I think that's right. Emerge.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the reasons that I've become really excited about, you know, the work going on in AI machine learning in the last few years is because, you know, in psychology, we've always developed theories that are very kind of micro scale, right? They're theories of a very specific cognitive function. And then the kinds of predictions that they make are, well, you're going to be a little bit slower on this kind of trial than this kind of trial. Or you're going to make these kind of errors, things like that, right? None of those theories could actually do anything, right? They couldn't go out and actually perform a task, right? We finally have AI models that can actually do tasks, that the kind of tasks that we would ask a human subject to do. So, you know, they're kind of stimulus computable end-to-end sorts of models. And most of them aren't good models for how, you know, humans do things, right? Because they weren't built to be models of how humans do things. They were built to be models to actually go solve a problem solve an engineering problem, right? Go drive a car without running people over, or go answer questions, you know, on a chatbot or things like that. But I think that those kind of models, nonetheless, they're almost certain, like, you know, let's take, take GPT-3, right? You can view GPT-3 as a model of how people reason or answer questions. It's not a very good one, right? It clearly doesn't reason or answer questions in the way that humans do in all cases. But nonetheless, you could treat it as a theory and then say, hey, let's figure out, like, what does it take to get a better theory that's modified not to be better at, you know, benchmarks, but to be better at actually behaving like a human, and figure out what are the things that would need to change in that sort of architecture to behave more like a human. And the cool thing about those kind of theories is then they allow you to basically start mapping, you know, the way that people have done on a smaller scale, for example, you know, with like reinforcement learning models, you know, you say you find signals from the model, like prediction error signals, and you ask, where in the brain, you know, do we see similar signals? Now we can start thinking about across these entire kind of end-to-end behaving models, how do they map onto brain function? Can we start to use them to kind of functionally or computationally characterize particular brain systems? In the way that people have started doing in the vision world with convolutional neural networks.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And I think right. I'm seeing more and more of that. Whereas, you know, I even have a colleague, Eric Wong, who's, you know, he's a physicist, but he's sort of playing with this too, and he's sort of like thinking, okay, well, maybe there's convolutional neural network models maybe apply to visual cortex or maybe cerebellum, and then there's other types of models like, you know, shallow associative neural networks that might be more relevant in you know, cortex or whatever. And so, and yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting because I think there's a lot of work to be done. And it's interesting to make sense of also, like, you know, there's a lot of people starting to, you know, Danny Bassett is, you know, starting to, you know, she has been for a long time trying to model fMRI data in some sense. And Randy McIntosh is doing dynamic modeling, and it's, you know, there's, there's sort of islands that are starting to, I think, just at the very beginning of sort of converging on a mechanism for thinking more deeply about this brain activation data. So it's not just...
Yeah. And I think actually that's you know, bringing up Danny and Randy's work is a great point, right? Because one of the big kind of chasms, I think, right now is that, you know, there are people on the, like take people from the kind of like neural networks world, right? They're, you know, some of them have started working on more kind of like, you know, recurrent architectures with dynamics, but a lot of the work in that world has been just like feed forward networks that don't really have dynamics, right? People like Danny and Randy have focused a lot on dynamics and not so much on computations, right? So the network neuroscience approach has been to, like, you know, take a brain and treat it as a bunch of nodes, right? And you don't care what the nodes do, right? You just care how they are connected to one another. And you know, you're using the same type of models you might use to analyze a power grid or an airport, you know, connection network, like whatever the network might be. And so I think bridging, like figuring out how do you bridge the insights from kind of network science with the insights from, like, you know, computational neuroscience and AI is a really critical one. I think there are people doing really good work along these lines, like, you know, people like David Cicillo and Laura Driscoll, you know, who've been working on these sorts of things. But I think there's a lot more work to be done to figure out, like, how do you bring together the computational side with the kind of network neuroscience side?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that's, yeah, I mean, emphasizing that point of enhancing those, that sort of analysis is, I haven't heard that discussed that much, and I think it's worth bringing out. And one thing that popped in my head, more nuts and bolts sort of thing, is, you know, with fMRI, I mean, it seems like a lot of these models, one slightly missing element with fMRI is that it's hard to differentiate, you know, inhibition from excitation, because it seems like so much of the brain organization is dependent upon this inhibitory and excitatory signals. It would be nice to be able to do that. And then who knows, we might figure out a way to do that in some way, but right now that's, that element's missing, and one doesn't know whether it's a critical element.
I agree. That's a fundamental problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So just quickly back to the open neuro, and before we go to a little bit more, we talked a little bit more about ontologies, but with open neuro, so one thing that I see, and I think it's a really cool thing, but also at the same time, I'm not really worried about it. But that, you know, when I go to OHBM, it seems that the culture of OHBM has changed. That I would say at least maybe a third of the young researchers there are, you know, they've never collected data on their own. They're just analyzing data, and I think that's so cool, because I think data should be reanalyzed and for new perspectives, and the methods are, it's very important. But at the same time, you know, I'm sort of maybe old school in the sense that I feel like there's something gained from actually going about coming up with an experiment and collecting the data and getting a real sense of the source of artifacts. And it really tempers and tunes your interpretation of the data. If there are good standards, maybe that's not totally critical, but I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree that, I think that there, let me first say, you know, I think that it's great that people who were not in a position to collect data can go do science, you know, without having collected data. And so that opens up science to a lot of people who wouldn't have been able to do anything, who might have, like, you know, really interesting computational ideas or theoretical ideas. Having said that, I completely agree that, you know, without having collected the data, without having gone through the experience of collecting data oneself, there's just a set of things that you don't learn about data. And I think that, you know, it certainly is the case that I think people who've never collected data approach data in a more kind of rose-colored glasses way than people who have, right? Because you realize when you've collected data, you realize all the things that can go wrong, right? Especially if you know, it's like you collect data and then you do QA right away because you want to make sure things are working, right? And the experience of having done QA really changes how you think about data.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, like in my lab, like, you know, I've certainly had postdocs, and I'm kind of okay with postdocs who show up who say, hey, I'm going to just work on data, right? For the most part, except for, you know, like, I certainly have some grad students in my lab who are just focused on the engineering side, right? They just want to develop methods. I don't insist that they get involved in data collection and designing experiments, but anybody who wants to do kind of neuroscientific work in my lab, I really, as a grad student, expect them not just to take data and play with them, but to really get involved in, you know, developing experiments and kind of seeing the entire process. Because I agree that, you know, that's a, it's a critical thing. I mean, one challenge, right, is that there's just, you know, I mean, compared to when you and I started, right, there's just so much more to know right now, right?
Yeah.
Or a grad student, you know, it's really daunting for them to both understand how to, like, you know, design an experiment, all the psychological stuff, and to understand all the neuroscience side, and to understand all the MR side, and understand all the analysis side, right? It's just, you know, it's like, I feel for them, right? Just because there's so much there. And so you might imagine at some point we end up sort of like physics, right? Where you have the experimentalist and the theorist, and then the important thing becomes that they know how to talk to one another, so that, you know, the theorists and from talking with physicists, I get the understanding that even in that field, there's kind of complicated relationships between theorists and experimentalists, right? It's not as smooth as one might think from looking at it, you know, from the outside. But I think that, you know, that we do have to worry and think about, you know, how do we address this challenge of just the amount that one has to know and the limited time that one has to develop expertise. And if you spend 5 years in graduate school, you can't become expert in all the stuff, right? You have to kind of say, what am I going to focus on? And then, you know, and obviously there's a lot of stuff that I have published on that I'm not expert on. And I've been lucky to have collaborators who can kind of, you know, tell me what I'm doing wrong so that we can do it right. And I think that's you're always going to have to think about that, right? When I started doing fMRI, I had no idea about MR, right? But I had Gary Glover across the street who I can collaborate with, who knew a lot about MR. And so I think we do have to think about, as things get more complex, just think about that collaborative model. Even if we don't go to the full kind of, like, you know, distinct, you know, calling somebody a theorist or experimentalist, just making sure that if you don't understand something well enough that's important for the work, that you have collaborators who do.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it really is substantially more that people have to know. And you know, they all have to, you know, everyone knows how to program, everyone knows how to, you know, work in that environment of, you know, data formats and things like that. And also at the same time, it's interesting because I also think that there's something about generating an experiment that is a creative sort of element too, that sort of forces you to think. Like, for instance, you know, when you look at the data, and maybe people can just do this also when they're analyzing data too, is that, you know, there's things like with fMRI, at least with fMRI, looking at things like the latency and looking at the various transients in the signal or the post undershoot or whatever that might be meaningful. That sometimes people, when they just go for the analysis of, you know, standard GLM or whatever, they might miss. And there's all kinds of interesting things that can be taught even without collecting the data though too.
This has always worried me about, you know, training programs that are called like cognitive neuroscience programs, right? Because there's something really powerful that's gained by training in a specific field. Like training, for me, it was training in cognitive psychology. For you, it was training in physics. For other people, it might be training in physiology, where you really learn how to ask questions about a very specific domain, right? And develop experiments. And I think that often the, you know, programs that are like cognitive neuroscience training programs give people like superficial experience in all the different parts, but without that deep experience, you're not really kind of learning what it's like to develop experiments in a sort of a thoughtful way. And it's a challenge because, you know, again, people need to know lots of stuff. So the question is, how do you get them to get that sort of more domain specific expertise in the context of this larger problem?
Exactly. And I think that's, you're right. That's the nature of a good graduate program, a good mentor that teaches them how to, you know, this sort of art of asking, of asking the questions. I mean, it really is all about that. I mean, you can actually just go and do stuff and generate data and even papers. But there really is, you know, you always find certain people are asking just the right question in just the right way. It's still kind
of, you know, I also have to say that I still, even though my lab does increasingly more, you know, kind of non-experimental work, you know, either infrastructure work, analysis work, I have more fun sitting down with trainees and thinking up a new experiment and kind of, you know, thinking through all the ways that it could go wrong and figuring out how to fix those ways that, that I, you know, it's one of the funnest parts of science in general. And so missing out on that, I think is also just missing out on the, you know, kind of the fun of actually, you know, doing science.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So a little bit about your cognitive atlas. I mean, I started, I have to admit, I haven't looked at that that much in the past, but I've looked at it recently. And yeah, I'm trying to get my head around, you know, we talked a little bit about this, but in terms of the way it looks right now, I mean, the way it looks right now is when I think of ontologies, I think of sort of like ways that you can structure new terms that are more precise or more mechanistic in terms of what the cognitive actions actually are, as opposed to things like, you know, working memory or attention.
Right. So I think there's a zeroth order goal, which is sort of one of the reasons that we started the project, was that going to cognitive neuroscience conferences and seeing people saying, oh, I have a task that measures working memory, right? And then seeing people measuring it in so many different ways and not it being clear that they're measuring the same thing. So the idea was like, you know, if we're gonna understand, you know, how cognitive functions map to brain functions, right? Well, you know, there are mental things in our head that psychologists study, right? We can't see them. We can only elicit them and measure them via cognitive tasks, right? And so whenever we have a person do a task in a scanner, we think it's, you know, evoking some particular set of cognitive functions. That's a theory about how that task gets done. It may or may not be right. But unless we write down that theory, unless we know exactly what the mappings are meant to be between, you know, task X and cognitive function Y, we can't start to then say, well, is it really the case that working memory maps onto this particular brain region or network, right? Because if that's true, then we should be able to take any task that supposedly taps into working memory and it should, you know, evoke activity in that task. So one of the very early goals was just to basically say, what are we trying to do with cognitive neuroscience, right? When we give people tasks, what are the things we think are being evoked? Because you can sort of see people nodding to those in their papers when they write about, you know, in-back task evoking working memory or, you know, whatever. But, you know, in psychology, there's, you know, been this longstanding ideas about, you know, how it is that you kind of define psychological constructs and then validate those constructs, you know, ideas going back to people like Paul Meehl in the 1950s. And those ideas have not been brought to bear on how we think about, you know, cognitive neuroscience studies. So one way to conceptualize what we're trying to do is really formalize what it is that people think they're measuring so that then we can actually go in and try to break it, right? It might be right in some ways. It might be that, you know, that this thing that we call working memory, you know, is really 12 different things and we're mashing them all together. But without kind of knowing all the, you know, the without formally saying like, you know, these are all the tasks that we think measure working memory. Now let's go see how they relate to one another. Then we can't really validate those relationships between sort of, you know, brain systems and cognitive functions.
So when I look at this, it's like, right, there's a list of the operations, there's a list of the tasks. So right now is there, like, for instance, with different types of working memory, how in that website, in the cognitive atlas then, so you have like a listing then of all the types of things that might invoke, like, you know, working memory. It's very comprehensive. And, but I guess what I'm, you know, it would be nice to sort of be able to ultimately is to simplify everything in some sense to say, well, you know, this, you know, maybe working memory is just sustained attention to internal processes or something, whatever. You know, it'd be nice to be able to sort of, you know, once you get this, to sort of be able to collapse it across certain principles of what's going on. And you know.
Yeah. And we've always thought that, you know, neuroscience data are one way to think about doing that, right? So for example, if there's, you know, some people say they have a task that measures working memory. Other people say they have a task that measures sustained attention. And if we see that those tasks systematically evoke similar patterns of brain activity, right, then that tells us that maybe those two constructs are not really distinct, right? Similarly, if you say, well, we're measuring working memory, and I look across the tasks that measure working memory, and I see that they systematically differ in their patterns of activity depending on like what else is going on, right? You know, for example, you know, let's say that, you know, some of them are doing working memory for one type of material and some for another type of material, and I see systematically different patterns, then that might tell me that, you know, there might be some distinctions between those things we call working memory. Or if we can find some degree of commonality, then we can start to pull apart what's common, what's distinct. Those are the kind of things that we ultimately would like to be able to do. The real challenge is mapping. So we have all these tasks listed in the Cognitive Atlas. And ultimately, it's not necessarily the task. It's really the kind of the contrast, right? Because if I give you a Stroop task, right, there's a lot of different comparisons I might do. I might ask about, you know, activation for congruent trials versus rest, or I might ask about incongruent versus congruent. We're really mapping down to the individual contrast on the task, but then we need mappings between those and the data sets. So that's what, like in the paper I mentioned that John Walters did, we sat down and went and took each task and mapped it on, or each contrast and mapped it onto a contrast in the Cognitive Atlas. And that let us then do that analysis. But that was hours and hours of us reading papers, understanding the task, and then coming up with our best theory about how that works. Somebody else might come up with a different theory, right?
I mean, it almost seems that, I mean, this might also, if you can put the data in the right way, like you said, look at the contrast. And this also might be something for GPT-3 to, you know, to sort of parse through this and come up with unifying principles.
I think that there's a lot of potential for, I don't think we know yet how well those types of models could work in much more kind of, you know, like domain specific sorts of ways. For example, like saying, you know, what task is this? What contrasts are being measured in this particular, you know, study, right? And, you know, unfortunately, to do that well, we need access to a lot of text, and a lot of text still lives behind paywalls. I don't think abstracts of papers are going to be sufficient to do that. Getting access to, you know, to all of that will be challenging, but I think, and, you know, we've been involved in some projects that have started trying to do that, like this NeuroQuery project with Gael Veracroix and colleagues, that, you know, has tried to mine text, relate it to coordinates rather than to actual brain maps. But, you know, if you could relate text to actual maps, for example, using NeuroVault, that would provide a much more powerful way to, I think, do this.
Yeah. So there could be much more discussion about that. But I just want to shift gears slightly because I think, right, it was on Twitter, and I think in the all the discussion about the BWAS paper. I think your name came up, and I think that's how, you know, we decided it would be great to have you on. But so maybe let's talk a little bit about just a little bit about that, and maybe kind of curious what your take on that. I mean, certainly there's been a lot of discussion about the BWAS paper, and on one hand, people are saying, oh my gosh, fMRI is not sensitive because it takes 2,000 subjects to get this this effect. I tend to argue, and other people tend to argue that. Maybe there were issues in terms of, you know, the homogeneity of the population being compared, the type of thing that they were using, looking at resting state, or I actually think that individual differences in structure and in, you know, functional organization, even spatially, how you actually try to align all this data smears things a lot too, and might reduce the effect size. So what's your thought on that? Especially relevant to certainly, you know, ultimately, you know, coming up with biomarkers or clinical applications.
So, you know, I found the paper compelling. It didn't really tell us anything that you couldn't know from like statistical theory, right? You know, if you know the effect size. So I guess the thing we learned from it is like, what are the realistic effect sizes with these kind of data, with these kind of behavioral phenotypes, right? And I totally agree that the imaging measures and the phenotypes may not be optimal, right? Nonetheless, people have been trying to do exactly those kind of studies with much smaller samples for a long time, right? So what it does is it gives us kind of like the, it tells us if you want to use the kinds of phenotypes and the kinds of imaging measures that people have been using in the literature for a while, this is what you can expect. This is the best you can hope to do. And maybe, you know, maybe that particular data set wasn't exactly the right one, you know, but I think, you know, it seems generalizable across other data sets. In some sense, it's no different than what people in the genetics literature have learned over the last 20 years, right, with genome-wide association studies, that I think it makes sense that you wouldn't necessarily expect, like, you know, connectivity between two particular brain regions in a healthy population to account for a lot of variability between people in some particular psychological function, right? It's probably going to be something much more global. And so I think that, you know, my takeaway is we certainly can do better, and, you know, along the lines that you mentioned. But I think it's more a kind of a cautionary tale about just taking what we have and easily and, you know, doing large scale analyses and, you know, coming up with quote unquote biomarkers. And so it certainly throws some cold water on that, but I hope that it, you know, and I think they've been clear that, you know, this does not impugn all of fMRI, right? You know, and they've been actually very excited about, you know, that group has been very excited about doing, you know, much denser imaging on much smaller samples, right? And I think has shown that you can do that and get, like, you know, interesting new neuroscientific insights into, you know, functional organization of the brain. So I think it's mostly just a cautionary tale about, you know, about understanding, you know, what are the plausible effect sizes you can hope to get in a study, and then realizing what power you need in order to get those.
Yeah. Right?
So it's almost certainly going to be the case that, yeah, with the data we have now and the analyses we have now, that there's a lot of studies that, you know, that people probably had in their head that this particular finding says you should not go do that study with 100 subjects, right? And so I think that it will be interesting to see if we, you know, can figure out, for example, you know, address the alignment issues, address the behavioral reliability issues, address the imaging reliability issues, address the homogeneity issues, you know, if all those issues can be addressed, how well can you do? One would hope you can do better. But, you know, it may just be that fMRI is also, in terms of individual differences and kind of, you know, accounting for the differences between people, for at least for kind of like in the healthy population, obviously there are going to be, you know, sort of like edge cases, you know, tails of the distribution, just like there are in genetics, right? You know, what we know now from genetics is that, you know, there are rare variants that can have huge effects, right? Common variants across people very rarely have sort of large effects in genetics. And that's probably the case in imaging too. In part just because, you know, just as with genetics, those things are going to get, you know, they're probably going to get filtered out by, you know, by evolution. So I think it's, you know, I think it, while it does throw water on stuff, it also opens up a whole new set of questions about how can we improve our ability to find those kind of relationships.
Yeah, no, definitely it illustrated to me that, right, there's maybe more in, I mean, certainly looking at fMRI data, you can actually get a significant effect from a single study, single run. And so you have, you know, fMRI is very sensitive, but it seems that, right, there's potentially more variability, you know, among people. And, but yeah, so certainly it does open up the nature of the problem a little bit more clearly in this regard.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think it's good that it just forces, you know, Tal Yarkoni had a paper that was actually in the same issue as the Vol paper back in 2009 that highlighted exactly this problem of the, you know, the low reliability of correlations with small samples, right? And so it's, again, something we've known for a long time. And I think that this paper simply highlights it in a, you know, in a splashy way.
Yeah, a lot of work to be done as far as that's concerned. And certainly, I think that there is a lot of potential, which maybe we can talk on in another podcast, of looking at individual differences and certainly looking at, I mean, I don't think in this one we'll talk in depth. Maybe we'll mention it. So you're also, one of the things you did that was novel and bold and, you know, sort of as you do, is your My Connectome study. And I love that idea. And I think there should be more studies like that. And, you know, in which you scanned yourself twice a week for how long was it?
With some breaks, about a year and a half.
About a year and a half. And I think that, right, that data could be, I mean, it's probably being mined in many different ways. Is there anything, there are many things you found from this, but I mean, is there still new information coming from that data as far as that's concerned?
I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's probably, you know, it's been mined so much now. There's at this point, at least like 30 something papers that have used the data for lots of different things. You know, I think it's largely probably at this point being used more for validation sorts of stuff than it is for kind of, you know, new discovery. But I think there's probably still is stuff in there to, you know, to be mined. I mean, you know, it's interesting because people often want to know, like, what did you learn about yourself from doing the study? And I can't say that like the data told me much about myself at all. But I think that they, you know, there's a couple. So in the paper that Tim Lauman wrote and published in 2015, based on those data, you know, I think there were a couple of really interesting things that came out of that I think have been probably the most impactful findings. One was simply, you know, how much data do you need on an individual to get highly reliable estimates of functional connectivity? And I think that, you know, the analyses of that data set showed a lot more than people thought, right? You know, so that's why, you know, a lot of groups are now collecting 30 minutes or more of functional data per person rather than the 5 to 10 minutes that they used to collect.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I think the most novel, interesting finding, and this is, you know, this is not something that I or my team would have discovered, is really, you know, Tim Lauman and Steve Peterson's group who sort of found this, was the sort of functional variance, right? So the idea that, you know, we all have this kind of global organization. So let me, for those of you who don't kind of know the story, right? So I had started this study and Steve Peterson heard about it and we had a phone call and he's like, hey, we're really interested in taking your data and using them to ask whether these like individualized parcellation tools we have are reliable. Right, they've never had enough data on one person to do that. They wanted to take my data and do it. So we had, you know, we ended up with about, I think in that analysis it was about 12 hours worth of data, something like that. And they started by just like splitting it into two and saying, if you do these parcellation tools, do you get consistent these kind of like connectivity based parcellations? Do you get consistent parcellations across the splits? And the answer was yes, they're actually quite reliable. And then the next question is, what do the parcellations look like? And so if you do those on like, you know, smaller data, you know, you see basically like everybody has like, you know, the medial prefrontal cortex is kind of mapping into the default mode network.
Yeah.
Right. When they did it on my data, they saw that for the most part, my medial prefrontal cortex mapped onto the default mode data, but there were a couple of parcels in there that were more strongly connected with other networks, like the salience network. Right. And the question was like, am I just a weirdo? Is something wrong with my brain? Or is that is that something that we see in everybody? And so, you know, Nico Dosenbach's group, along with Steve and others, has gone on to really, I think, demonstrate conclusively that starting with their Midnight Scan Club and then additional analyses of like HCP, that everybody has these functional variants, right? They're all in different places for each individual. And that's why when you average a bunch of people together, you see, oh, the entire medial prefrontal cortex maps into default mode network. But it turns out that each of us has these little islands of sort of, you know, different connectivity. And, you know, they've gone on to show that they seem to have some behavioral relevance. So that's like something that nobody had ever seen until they had this amount of data. And so to the degree that I'm really proud of like one interesting novel finding, I think that that's probably the one. The other thing that I think is really cool is that this has kind of moved other groups to completely change how they do their imaging, right? So, yeah. You know, I think Nico's group is one, you know, Randy Buckner's group at Harvard now, like, you know, is doing like, you know, pretty much exclusively doing this kind of like really dense characterization of individuals. My group, all of the new imaging studies that we do now, we're collecting many hours of data per person. Whereas, you know, we used to collect, you know, 1 hour long session probably. So I think it's changed the way that people do imaging as well. And I think that's a cool thing.
I totally agree with that. And I think that there's benefit from, you know, there's sensitivity to be gained from looking at one single subject very, very deeply. And
your group has certainly done great work along those lines as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're still right. It's funny because that data set keeps on coming up in which we, you know, we scan, you know, somebody doing a very simple task for, in this case, it was over 10 hours, but, still, I mean, we're still trying to make sense of that as well.
And so that's been another great example, I think, of how like the availability of this kind of data set can completely change that data set changes how we think about activation and what it means, right? When the whole brain can basically activate for a simple task pretty much or deactivate, right?
Right.
What does that tell us?
Yeah. And it tells you, right, there's a lot more in the transients. I mean, doing simple, I mean, one thing that study actually told me is that, you know, just modeling it with a simple, you know, simple hemodynamic response function is, I mean, the hemodynamic response is probably consistent, but the neural response is very potentially different depending on the area. And you might miss all that if you just have oversimplified models. Yep. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot to be gained from doing individual subjects over and over again before people just try to do broadly across many subjects. So maybe on that note, this was the fastest hour and 15 minutes that I think I've spent in a long time. Maybe just to conclude this particular, this episode right here, as far as the future is concerned, the more I think about fMRI, I mean, certainly there's many problems and also other imaging techniques. There's certainly challenges and there's certainly limits. We haven't even talked about clinical applications, but how optimistic are you? And how do you think the field will look? In not only in terms of, maybe let's focus it on, you know, how much it will elucidate how we understand the brain, maybe in, you know, the next 10 years or so. And how will we get there?
I think that's exactly the right question to ask. And I think I have mixed feelings, right? I think the thing that gives me optimism is in part the degree to which our field has, you know, at least in part been pretty self-reflective and self-critical and tried to not just kind of stick our heads in the sand when problems come up, but really figure them out and address them, you know, with, you know, for example, things like, you know, HCP and ABCD, right, which have come together to try to, you know, amass large data sets and whatever problems those studies may have, they're great examples of people, you know, putting in a ton of work to basically generate data for other people to analyze, right? Rather than kind of holding on to it themselves and requiring people to collaborate with them and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I think they're great examples of our field really deciding that, you know, we need to have the data to ask the questions that we want to ask. So I'm optimistic about that. I'm optimistic about, you know, sort of coming together with people using other more invasive methods in animal models and figuring out how do we bridge the gap so that we can map what you can learn from mechanistic studies, you know? And I think that now with the availability of, you know, optogenetic fMRI in rodents, you start to be, even though obviously there are challenges, there are a lot of things we're never going to be able to map well between humans and rodents, but you still start to be able to ask a set of questions that you might not have been able to ask before. Mm-hmm. You know the landscape on kind of newer fMRI methods more than I do. You know, I still remain pretty skeptical that, you know, within the next 10 years, we're going to have a broadly accessible fMRI method that's going to like fundamentally change, you know, fundamentally overtake bold fMRI that everybody's doing right now. I think it'd be great if we could to get it at other sorts of things. And then I think that the other thing that gives me optimism is the theoretical side, right? Having access to particularly the new theories from AI and machine learning that we can use to get more insight from the data we have. I mean, it's certainly going to be fundamentally limited, you know, and I still remain pretty skeptical on, you know, about whether it's going to ultimately be useful, for example, for clinical biomarkers at the individual level. And I think that there's probably a lot of like misplaced optimism about that right now, But ultimately, I think I'm, you know, the way that our field has responded to these challenges and the kind of the, you know, the ongoing development of new tools and models makes me somewhat hopeful.
Okay. All right. Well, on that hopeful note, and I agree with literally everything you said, and is including the biomarker, you know, tempered enthusiasm as far as that's concerned. I think we have a lot of work to do to really understand even what that means and how to actually ask the right questions about that. With that note, I'd like to thank you for coming on. This has been great, and hopefully we'll have you back again because there's so much more we could talk about. So.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure, and I'd love to come back anytime.
Great. All right, thank you.
Neurosilience is brought to you by Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode is produced by Ömer Faruk Gülban and Jeff Mantis.